Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, A Death in the Dry River by Lisa Allen Agostini, and my most recent book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. You can also support the show by buying us a cup of coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. Lilith Dorsey is a proud Black author and comes from a Celtic, Afro-Caribbean, and Native American spirituality. They are the editor and publisher of Oshun African Magical Quarterly and filmmaker of the documentary Bodies of Water, Voodoo Identity, and Transformation. They are co-host of the YouTube show Witchcraft and Voodoo. Lilith is also the author of Voodoo and Afro-Caribbean Paganism from Citadel, 2005, and Orishas, Goddesses, and Voodoo Queens, out from Wiser in 2020. Their latest book is Tarot Every Which Way, out from Llewellyn in July 2024. Lilith Dorsey, I'm so excited to say this. Welcome to Witchlit.
Oh, thank you. It's such an honor and a pleasure to be here. I'm excited for our conversation.
Yeah, me too. So our first question for everybody, and I think because you do so much stuff, you're so involved in your community in New Orleans, you have a YouTube show, you're publishing. So why write? Why still write books?
Some days I really wonder, right? because I never wanted to write books. You know, I started out getting a film degree. I used to make experimental films back in the late 80s when nobody even knew what that was, you know? And then I sort of left NYU to go and have my oldest daughter. And there was no film program there. So I ended up studying anthropology, which was my second love, you know? So I think that when I went back to school and became a documentary filmmaker, that sort of all tied it in together. But, you know, paper, computer, way cheaper than film. So,
yes.
So this was just the best way for me to reach people, you know, and it's been such a surprise because so many people tell me that, you know, what I write changes their lives or really help them through difficult times. And that's so important to me. That's what it's all about, right?
So we, in the bio, I mentioned a couple of your books plus this new one, but you've written several more books than that. So when did your first book come out?
I've lost count now at this point. The first one came out in 2004, and that's like right after I finished grad school. That's right when I started dancing and choreographing for jazz legend Dr. John. So that was a big year.
Yeah, that's a lot.
So yeah, it's been 20 years of traditionally published books.
Yeah. So what was getting that first book published like? What was that journey?
I wouldn't have done it. I'm such an Aries. I wouldn't have done it if it wasn't already sold. Mm-hmm. And I had a good friend that was starting a publishing company. And he had said to me, okay, you have the newsletter already. You're writing this fantastic stuff. Like, how about you write the ultimate beginning book? Every, you know, questionable question you get. And those of us who've been in the business for a long time knows there's a lot of those questions, you know. So I agreed to do it because he was going to buy it. And then what happened was that folded. The publishing company folded before it even got out. So then he agreed to represent me as my agent. And it was so nice of him. And then I ended up getting it published. It was great.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, that publishing house closing before the book comes out is often a horror story for people. So I'm glad there's a happy ending there.
Yeah, it is. I was so mad too. I was like, I spent all this time on this book. You better publish this. So it's like, yeah, don't worry about it. I got it.
Yeah.
So
one of the things I thought I noticed right away when I was reading the book, other than the fact that I love having so much more information for each tarot card. And I hope when people pick it up, they'll see that. But you mentioned in the introduction that this is a book you wanted to write for a long time. So what do you feel like was the reason it took till now? Or is it just the time for this book?
I felt like I had to know, not that I know everything about tarot, but I've been reading professionally for almost 40 years now. So I feel like there's some cards that will be different if they come up for a young person or an old person or a person of a different gender. So understanding how they operate across a wide range of people, across a wide variety of situations, I had to understand that. And since this is really, I guess, at its core, a book of correspondences, I wanted to make sure it wasn't just, oh, well, this person over here said it corresponds to this thing. So mm-hmm. that's what it is. I wanted to really try and understand that on a deeper level, you know, mm-hmm. like the lover's card and rose quartz. Sure, there's a natural connection between those two things.
Yeah.
But what does it really mean if I take a piece of rose quartz out and I put it on the lover's card when I get the reading? How does that change my life and the outcome of what I'm seeing in the cards?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that approach to tarot where it's not just divinatory, but it's also like not remedial, but like here's what could happen. Here's what you can do. Like, I guess that kind of aspect of it, like it's not necessarily written in stone. So I guess remediation might be the right thing if it's a bad reading.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we want actionable steps. We were kind of chatting about this before mm-hmm. that for me, if you're getting a reading, yes, it's important to know what's going to happen, but what can you do to make the best possible outcome within what you're seeing in the cards? Mm-hmm. You know, I talk about in the book how one time I got the tower card, right? Like, it's like the soap opera card for everything's going to go really, really crap, you know? And I was like, huh, you know, I got all nervous. I'm like, oh, should I not drive today? Or should I, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that my water heater had bust, and the deck I was using was the New Orleans Voodoo Tarot, which the tower is the deluge. So it's this flood. So I literally had a flood in my basement, and it wasn't great, but at least I knew it wasn't like, oh my God, tragedy, run around like a chicken with your head cut off. You know?
Yeah. It sounds like you've had a couple like really immediate experiences with the cards, which I always find fascinating. Like it just like there's no gap between what the card says and then what happens. It's always interesting.
Yeah, it usually does play out pretty quickly, you know, and I think there's definitely ways that you can cultivate that if that's something that you want. You know, I always recommend people do a daily pull when mm-hmm. they're starting out, you know, and so if it's going to be, oh, you get the Two of Cups, I talk about this in the book too. Here's the Two of Cups, which for me is always marriage, you know, and I lived in New York City for a long time and I'm on the subway and one of those panhandlers comes up singing to me and trying to get money and gets down on one knee and proposes to me. And I was like, okay, thank you, Two of Cups. You got jokes. Like,
yeah. It's good to have a sense of humor.
Sure. You always need a sense of humor.
Yeah. I love the recipes with the cards. Like I love that idea and just because I'm a cook too. So it was just like, oh, that's, I had never really thought about it that way. So that was really cool. And the musical note, like, of course, but it never occurred to me that there would be a musical note. So how did you get to the both of those, I guess, to the recipes and the musical notes? Because those seem like the newest things to me just as the reader.
Yeah, well, the recipes I worked on for a long time. I did a series on my YouTube channel about different Tarot Every Which Way recipes for the major arcana cards. And that was about 10 years ago. So again, I've been working on this for a long time. And it was just basically a combination of, okay, the research, 3, 4, 5 different practitioners, writers, authors, you know, priests and priestesses say that this is associated with this card. So what are the recipes that include these things heavily that could possibly go with this card? Mm-hmm. And then just trial and error, having events where I would cook these things for people and see how they felt about it, not just from a culinary perspective, but also magically. How do you mm-hmm. feel like after you eat these things? How do you, you know, how does that change your perspective? How does that change your body, your mind, your soul, your spirit, all those things moving forward? So that's how that came about. And the musical notes was pretty much the same way. I did sort of a survey of what other people's accepted things were and then tried it out and saw how that resonated with different musicians, different practitioners and things like that, and sort of settled on the ones that ended up in the book.
Yeah. That I was thinking about it as I was reading. It's like if you did a reading with just the major arcana cards, could you basically write a song that way? Like it would
definitely, you that could. That would be beautiful.
I mean, I'm not a musician, but I was like, that would be fascinating to me. Because I mean, I know there's people
that would be beautiful.
Like you said, done movies that are based on tarot. There's books that, you know, they use the tarot to write the book. So it's just like, oh, you could do music this way too. That'd be amazing.
Of course you could. This is your reading based on what the notes are that go with the cards. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I love
that. We did
a
poetry thing here in town in New Orleans about a month ago, where everybody had a different card that they wrote poetry for or some sort of literary thing. And that was really interesting because a lot of the writers weren't necessarily familiar. So it really was just like their reading, you know, they picked this card and then they just went with it. So it was beautiful.
Cool. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I really like that. Yeah, New Orleans just seems like the most magical place.
We have a lot of magic going on. It's beautiful. I love living here now.
Yeah. So what brought you to New Orleans? Like, what was the draw for you?
I mean, I was coming down 4, 5, 6 times a year at that point. You know, I'd come down for Mardi Gras when Dr. John was still alive. I'd either come down to perform or to see him. I have so many friends here. Just because I write a lot about voodoo and magic, it sort of makes sense that, you know, I'd be here. I was doing workshops and stuff like that. And ultimately, I moved at the beginning of the pandemic. So I had just bought a house on March 1st of 2020, and everything in New York City sort of shut down right around the middle of March. So it sort of made sense that, like, oh, you were going to move anyway. Now it's time to move, you know.
Time to go,
It was a lot cheaper than buying. There's no way I could have bought a house with land in New York City.
Oh, yeah.
As much as I would want to, it's not really an option.
Yeah. I feel you from my rented house in San Jose. It's the same, same kind of thing here. It's so funny how many people I know moved during the pandemic. I mean, we moved during the pandemic. I mean, so many people kind of shifted where they were. It was a topsy-turvy moment, to say the least.
It was. And for me, like, you know, I missed gardening so much. I even had like a amateur landscape business with my mom in New York City because we didn't have yards and stuff. And then we got to take care of other people's yards. But having my own, you know, garden now, I have a community garden. I'm hopefully in the process of doing more with that and getting more property for community gardens. So, you know, that's just so important to me to be able to do what I love and give back, you know.
Do you think, kind of shifting that perspective, I mean, you were always kind of in New Orleans anyway, it sounds like, but do you think it's like changed your writing or how you think about other places you've lived?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think everybody has a love-hate relationship with the town, even people who were born here and grow up here. There's so many absolutely wonderful things. And then it's really challenging, you know, like we have an insane amount of tourists. We have, you know, insane weather, we have insane crime, like we have all of those things, you know, it's very difficult to live here. But then, you know, for Mardi Gras and the religion and the history and the herstory and all of that stuff that's here, there's no other place in the world like it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, New Orleans is a country unto itself, I think.
It is. I took a Southern cinema class once and my teacher who was Southern was like, yeah, it's a third world country stuck to the end of the United States. And as much as I don't want to say that, you know, there's a lot of comparisons, I think, you know.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I always think of New Orleans, too, is it's the have and have not is very stark there, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, that's true in a lot of American cities, but I think you see it. You really see it in New Orleans, even as a tourist, you see it. It's different. So.
Yeah, it's very extreme here. There's some very, very rich people. And then there's some very, very poor people.
Yeah.
And everything in between. But like I said, it's rough. You know, even the people that I think would be okay somewhere else. I have friends that just moved out from California and they're like, we thought we'd be ahead because the house prices were cheaper, but everything else was so much more expensive and everything else that they're dealing with, you know, so.
Yeah.
It's not just my story. It's everybody's story.
Yeah.
I tell people when they move here, I'm like, it's rough. It's not just going to be la, la, la.
Yeah.
Everything is fantastic. I'm in the magic city, you know, because it's rough.
Yeah. I think about New Orleans and Detroit that way too. Like Detroit is doing all these really cool things and people see it from the outside. But when you get on the ground there, it's a little bit of a different story too. Like it's a hard city to live in.
But they are doing
really cool stuff. It's like New Orleans, it's a hard place to live, but there's so much cool stuff going on. So,
yeah.
But I don't know. I was born in Detroit, so I have a soft spot always for Detroit. Cool. So what's on your slate now? So you've got your YouTube channel, you've got all kinds of stuff going on. So what's your writing and life look like now?
I'm doing a lot of poetry. I think that's a lot of fun. I love performing again. You know, Silver Ravenwolf did the foreword for my tarot book. And she had said to me last year, she's like, you're going to be performing a lot more. And I was like, what? You know, but I guess I am. So that's great.
Nice.
I miss it. I miss performing, you know, so that's a lot of fun. And performing my writing is great. Mm-hmm. I really love doing that. So hopefully there'll be more of that. I've got my, you know, summer events and things, you know, when this year's they'll be done, but I've got some really fun events that I do here, you know, in October. I'm actually, what are they calling me? I think I'm some sort of vampire accessory or something. I don't know, but I got, I get to go to the Endless Night Vampire Ball here. So that's always a lot of fun.
Oh, fun.
There's so many, you know, we've got Midsummer Mardi Gras. We've got all of the Day of the Dead parades. We've got all of those things that are always kind of happening here. Mm-hmm. Last year, I got to march with a Mardi Gras crew, the Crew de Vue, which is kind of the all political, sexual, you know, smoke weed kind of crew. So that's a lot of fun.
Nice.
Anybody who's here knows that, like, yes, it's weird that I'm thinking about it so many months in advance, but it's a lot. It's a lot. Costumes and parades and all of those things, you know, so.
Well, it's like the planning for next year starts when Mardi Gras ends, right? I mean, that's kind of how it works.
It does in a lot of ways, you know, because there's, again, so many things. But I'm always a last minute person too. There's always that moment of, okay, here I am, you know, 10 hours before, still gluing my costume together and sequins on the floor and glitter in my ears. And, you know, that's just how it
totally
goes sometimes.
So Halloween, Samhain in New Orleans, what's that like?
It's a lot of fun. I mean, this year it's going to be weird because apparently New Orleans is going to host a Taylor Swift concert that time of year. So we're going, all the hotels are already booked up and a lot of the normal events that we would do on Samhain have been pushed back because of that. So that's entertaining, but yeah.
Taylor kind of takes over when she lands.
Yeah. I mean, it was the same deal. We had Beyonce last year, you know, so it was the same deal when they came to town, but it gets intense. You know, we usually get 10 million tourists a year, but when something's as big as that, you know, it's really intense.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be fun. But we usually do, I do a lot of ancestor things all the time with my spiritual godchildren, rituals and feasts and things like that. And obviously that amps up during the Samhain time. And then also the Day of the Dead, we have an amazing Day of the Dead parade here where they do a candlelight processional. People can, you know, walk and leave offerings at the cemetery at the end. And it's really beautiful. It's really beautiful.
Yeah. We, so when we first moved to California, we lived closer. Well, we lived in Santa Clara, so not in San Jose, which is pretty close. It's kind of a suburb of San Jose, but we're in San Jose now and we're in the historic, like, Spanish speaking neighborhood. And about, I don't know, four blocks from us, they have the Avenue of the Altars for Day of the Dead. And so people just put up all the ofrendas and just for like, I don't know, six, seven blocks, just solid.
Wow,
it was beautiful. Yeah, it's really neat.
I love that. I love that.
Yeah, the Day of the Dead celebration. It's so, like, you know, I think I always think Halloween as it's celebrated is like kind of the spooky, you know, but there is like a playfulness to it. But Day of the Dead to me, always like the joy of it is so much more evident, I guess, with the marigolds and like the flags and everything. It's just so bright and colorful and joyous in a way that, you know, honoring the ancestors, I think sometimes we get a little gloomy about it or gothic about it. And there's this whole other way to kind of celebrate. So it's lovely to see.
Yeah, I love that. And I love being able to share the foods. You know, I remember last year I got some pan de muertos for a friend of mine who's Mexican. He's like, this tastes like my grandma's house.
Oh,
you know, and that was just so sweet to me. You know, you get transported back, right? Like, since we're talking about literature, like Proust and the macaroons, like this is the pan de muertos and Abuelita's house, you know?
Yeah.
So nice.
I love that.
So nice.
Yeah. One of the things, and it's funny you bring up the priest thing, like one of the things of reading it, I was like, even though it's a book of correspondences, that there's not, I mean, there are intros to each chapter, but there's not like a lot of long text pieces like in some of your other work that I've read. But it's so clear in your writing, like there's so much depth there about like the just the references you make and and kind of your voice in the way you write. Like it's, I don't know, it's very uniquely you. Like when I picked it up, I was like, oh, this is Lilith. This is, there's no like, you just have this very unique writing voice that I really enjoy.
Oh, thank you. I fight for it. You know, there's always a little bit of a struggle with editors and things like that. I'll put stuff in like, you know, some obscure thing, like I just Proust and the Madeleines or something. And people will be like, get that out of there. And I'm like, no, leave that in there.
No, that Proust stays.
Yeah, right. Just because you don't know who he is, leave me alone.
Yeah. No, I mean, I get caught up in that a lot too. And I think, you know, like, especially coming from like an experimental film and anthropology background, like those are just going to be touch points, right? I mean, that's just kind of going to show up in your work. There's really no way around it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I think having that authentic voice, ultimately, that's all we have. You know, somebody asked me, I think it was my Authors Guild union asked me about like, what's your advice? And I was like, write for yourself, fight for your words. You know, I know people are not going to think that's popular, but for me, that's so important, you know, and if your name's going to go on that book or that piece or whatever, you want it to be what you want it to be. I mean, I'm not saying make it a mishmash, you know, whatever, like with a bunch of grammar
editors
errors
do
or
know
something.
What they're doing. Yeah.
You know, but I mean, silly things like Grammarly won't let you begin the same sentence with the same word, you know, like, which is one of my normal conventions. I'm like, I do this, I do this, I do this, you know, like, that's just how I write, you know, I'm sorry, it doesn't go against your weird wacko rules, but it's correct. So please keep it the way I wrote it. Thank you.
Yeah. Grammarly always reminds me of like the most pedantic, like high school English teacher.
Yes.
I'm like, no, this is not modern contemporary English in a lot of ways. Like so much has changed.
No. Well, and that's what I'm hoping will save me from the AI monsters. You know what I mean? Because the way I write is so bizarre that it's not, you know, it's not being used as grammar.
The AI thing. Like, I mean, I feel like there was already like the kind of ghostwritten garbage books in the occult space that were just, you know, cash cows for disreputable publishers. I'm probably going to get clapped back on that one. But and so now with like AI too, I'm like, I just feel like it's our niche is so small, and to be threatened both by, you know, just garbage publishing and then also now AI stuff that's just blatant plagiarism. It's just really disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, it's me and so many other authors I know have like cheap copies of the books that we've written, you know, that are just AI jumbles, and people are buying them. People are buying them because, you know, my new book, I think, is $19.99. You know, they see something out there for $9.99. Most people are going to go, oh, yeah, this is the same topic. I'll just get this. You know, I don't blame them. I don't have very much money either. But the end result is, it's just worse for everybody. Whatever's in there is crap. It's the money's not going to an actual person. It's going to a corporation, and you might as well just throw your money away.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know like, especially with tarot decks, that seemed like the counterfeit tarot decks have been just really proliferating, like especially like drop shipping sites and stuff. And you're just like, these are blatantly stealing from creators, but they're, you know, $10 versus $30 for a pack of cards. So it's just disappointing.
Yeah. I mean, something like that happened with my first book. It went out of print, and then people could still buy some sort of weird digital copy online that was all pixelated or whatnot. I never got any money from that. I never found out who did it because, you know, I can't afford a bunch of money to hire a lawyer. So it just, it went away eventually, thank goddess. But it was very frustrating. You know, what am I going to do?
Yeah. I occasionally go cruising for my book titles to see like if they've shown up on free sites, and you can only play so much whack-a-mole. I mean, it's time, it's money to do that. But yeah, it's frustrating. And I think people, you know, like who are outside the publishing industry probably don't know like all of the ins and outs of that, but maybe talking about it helps a little bit.
I hope so. I mean, I know that it's a privileged position to be in as a published author, and I'm not saying that that's not. I'm just saying I think a lot of people also think it's really easy and we get all this money and all of these. And none of that is happening.
No. No, I mean, that. What is it? The average author makes a dollar or less per copy.
I make about $1 a copy.
It's not a lot.
Sell less than 2,000 copies in the life of a book. You know, I mean, I've been blessed that my titles do better than that, but I it's sad. It's so sad.
So it may look like a unicorn. And maybe, I mean, I think finishing a book, I will say anyone who actually finishes a book and gets it out there is probably a little bit of a unicorn. But that doesn't mean you magically get shed with gold.
So. Ain't that the truth? Yeah.
It's like, it is largely a labor of love, I think. And most writers I know have day jobs or have a partner who helps support them. I mean, that's how it goes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have either of those things, but the hustle is strong with me. So
there you go. Well, you've got a lot of stuff going on.
I do. I don't just write. That's for sure. You know, classes and readings and all the things, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's kind of, you have to kind of hustle if you're going to do that. Like there's no way to survive if you think you're going to live on royalties for most people. It's just not,
no, it's
a
not
reality.
Gonna happen. I mean, I remember talking to, you know, some of the biggest writers at the time when I started maybe 20, 25 years ago, you know, and they would tell me they'd be lucky to make more than 20,000, 30,000 a year. And that was 20 years ago. But most of that would come from readings or workshops or, you know, other things, products that they were making, other things like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think about I was at like our local bookstore before we moved from Tennessee. And I was talking to a writer friend who had had a book come out, and he was talking about a friend of his who had published, like, I guess in the 60s and 70s. And they'd sent him on like a nationwide book tour, and he flew and got his meals paid for and all that. And he was like, yeah, that doesn't happen anymore. And he was like, this was just like, a, you know, not even a mid-list academic book. And I was like, yeah, that would never happen.
No. No. You're right. I think people outside of the industry don't realize these things. You know, I grew up with, my parents were both in publishing, but they were like in the production side of things, you know? So I was always, we always had books. There was always a bunch of books around. And I knew that it was a business. So I think I at least had that starting out.
Yeah, it's so funny. Like so many writers I have talked to on the show and just know in real life, like grew up in a house full of books. Like I think it is like one of those seeds for writers to grow up surrounded by books or in bookish houses, maybe.
Definitely. I remember being little and saying, I want those pretty books up on the shelf. And they were like, you have to read first. So I taught myself how to read it. Mm-hmm. I think I was three. So I was like, okay. And they're like, you can't read that. And I was like, give me the book. Damn it.
I will show you.
I read it to them, you know. So, but, you know, gave me, I was bored. I was bored. I was an only child until I was about 7, 8. So I was bored.
Yeah. Self-entertaining. And you got a house full of books. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Oh, so for your YouTube channel, you often talk about like media and kind of how that, I guess, how media influences the occult and the cult influences media. Is there something like in that realm that you're really thinking about right now or something you want to share?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I love the show. As with my co-host, Jason Winslet, we have the Pop a Culture Show. And it's really sort of like an academic analysis of some of these occult pop culture things. And we've done some great things, Holy Mountain and Eve's Bayou, and we sort of did all of our favorites, you know, and I've known him for a long time, and I think we have a good sort of, I don't know what the word is to call it, goofy rapport going on.
Yeah, if folks haven't listened or watched it on YouTube, it's a delight. You should check it out.
Thank you. But no, we're gonna sort of redo it again when we come back after the summer. So in the fall, you'll see a whole bunch more shows. Hopefully we're going to get on other formats and things like that, not just YouTube. So that's really exciting.
Yeah.
I really like the fact that we've been having some amazing guests. We had our last show for the season last year was Richard Kaczynski. And we talked about Thoth Tarot sightings, which was fascinating to me because He's collected Thoth Tarot sightings for the past like 30 years. So we talked about seeing the Thoth Tarot on Heart to Heart for anybody who's our age, which was this really crappy detective show with this couple on it.
Yeah.
You know, all the different places it turns up and what that means and what mm-hmm. it means in those contexts. So, you know, we had Deborah Lipp talking about Live and Let Die. You know, a lot of people know Deborah Lipp as Gardnerian, famous author, you know, but she also wrote a fantastic book about James Bond. So that mm-hmm. was great. We're talking about the James Bond tarot deck. So I hope we get to do more things like that, where we have guests that are both, you know, occultists and popular occultists, but also have some sort of weird pop culture thing that they just fan geek about, you know, that we can talk about because we're all fan geeks at heart, right?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's like Heather Green's book that came out about, gosh, and the title has fallen out of my head. The Joys of Menopause. Your brain stops working.
I was like, lights, what is it?
Camera, bell, witchcraft. Camera?
Lights, camera, bell, witchcraft. That's it. Witchcraft. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I had her on the show too, which is even worse that I can't remember the name.
She's my editor.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah, Llewellyn, of course. But yeah, like that book and just the, like when we talked about it, it's like, and that book just covers American cinema. It doesn't even cover foreign cinema or even British cinema that, I guess foreign language and British is what I meant to say. British is also foreign, but it's in English. The foreign language for us and British cinema, and just like how pervasive the image of the witch has been, or like how often tarot shows up in films, especially in spooky genres. So it's, I mean, I think, you know, she's like, yeah, I could write 10 more books. It's like, yeah, you could probably have shows on YouTube or wherever for the rest of your life and not cover all of it.
So. Yeah, yeah. We started out with the basics, you know, Wizard of Oz and all of those kind of, which is Eastwick, all of those kinds of things. Yeah. But this second season, we really did the weirder stuff, the stuff that's less well known, a lot of international things and whatnot. And that's really, I think, what we want to do, you know, things that are stranger, things that are more bizarre. We had an episode about occult burlesque. We had, you know, we've been talking about comic books, like things that people usually don't talk about, you know, so that's very exciting.
Yeah. Occult burlesque is a topic close to my heart. Burlesque to me is just fascinating to watch. And I love what like modern contemporary queer burlesque has done with like a lot of those kind of occult topics and other things, and just pulling the weirdest stuff from pop culture and making it sexy. Like Boba Fett as a, you know, as a burlesque icon kind of stuff. So
yes, yes, it's amazing. It's amazing. So I loved that episode. You know, like we've done some good work. I'm really proud of it. So, and like I said, it's fun. You know,
and, well, I'm looking forward to your new season of stuff. Sounds exciting. But that is a lot of work on top of all of the other stuff you do. Like I know just from running a podcast, like producing the episode, editing, all of that stuff is just a lot of time. So how do you manage writing that, all of the other things you do, and just life? What's your organization secret, I guess?
I don't have an organization secret. I'm just really busy all the time. You know, I think it was funny. In some ways, I felt like I had more time to myself when I did have a regular, you know, 50, 60 hour a week job, you know, because for a long time I took care of kids. I love kids. And, you know, I was a nanny, so I could still get stuff done during nap time, or I could get stuff done when they were playing or whatnot, you know, whereas now I'm just working nonstop. Either it's promoting the book, or I still have the blog, Voodoo Universe. I have the YouTube channel. I have the performances. I have the gardens. I have all of these things that are going on at once, you know, so it's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah. So where do you find, how do you carve out time for yourself then?
I don't know what that is. No.
Sorry, Victoria, that does not exist.
I don't know. I still, you know, I mean, if it's a special occasion, I definitely try and get out. There's things that I love to do that I, you know, still try and make time for. I do love gardening. That doesn't seem like work to me, although now that it's 90 degrees and above, it seems more and more like work.
Yeah.
You know, so that's nice. Hopefully I'll be doing some traveling in the upcoming months, getting to spend time with my family. That's always great.
Yeah. Do you have family in New Orleans at all, or is everybody kind of
scattered? I don't have any family in New Orleans. My daughter's in Nashville, but she's almost never home because that's one of the reasons I have so many recipes in the book. She's a big food, restaurant, hotel, you know, consultant. So she's pretty much all over the world all the time consulting at different, you know, restaurants and hotels and stuff. And she's worked for some of the Michelin star chefs, David Chang and Danielle Ballou. So like, when I'm say I'm a foodie, I'm really a foodie.
You're hardcore, yeah. Yeah, well, you're in a foodie town too. I mean, New Orleans is, is a foodie place.
So we have a lot of fun. And all my friends are foodies, you know, so we try and foodie it up whenever we can. Yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah.
Did you get folks to test the recipes, or did you just test them, get them to taste? Like for the...
Oh, no, I got folks to test the recipes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely.
I wrote a cookbook, like a companion book for my series during COVID, and got testers. And just like, I was like, thank you so much, because I know getting some of these ingredients during COVID was really hard.
Oh, nice.
But it's so great to have people test, because I think you get, when you cook all the time, you kind of have a rhythm and you kind of know what you know and don't always think about it in the recipe, like when you're writing a recipe. I think just getting so many different people to do it, it's you just get a very different perspective on what other people need you to say in the recipe to make it work.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I grew up cooking, so you're right. Sometimes I don't necessarily realize people need to, you know, understand. There's a recipe in the book. I think it was one of my grandmother's recipes for orange marmalade, you know, and it's just so like 1900s, right? Mm-hmm. Like you get all your stuff together and then you add half as much sugar, you know, like, so I could see somebody who'd never cooked before just standing there looking at that, like, what does that mean? You
know, I don't understand. Yeah. No, it's true. And especially older recipes, because they really assume you already knew.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, you know, make a roux. Okay. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah. No, my godsons made gumbo without filet. And I was like, well, you don't have gumbo then. Like,
yeah, we always had to make it without filet.
So I sent them like 5 different kinds of filet.
Oh, nice. Yeah. We, it's hard to come by out here. I mean, you can get anything online, but like locally it's hard to get. But my brother's allergic to it, which we found out the hard way.
Oh,
he's allergic to sassafras.
That's weird. That's a weird allergy.
His lips swelled up, like his face swelled. And I was like, oh, this is bad. Wow. It's a bad allergy.
Oh, no.
So we didn't have filet growing up, but I'm of the it should have okra in it. And no one else in my house likes okra.
Oh, well, it's definitely a strange thing.
Yeah. And what is it? There are as many gumbos as there are cooks in New Orleans Louisiana.
Definitely.
Do you have a favorite recipe in the book? That's the one closest to your heart.
Oh, it's so hard. I don't know. Like, there's so many that I like. I mean, I tried to pick ones that were also healthy, you know, so that was important to me. I do love the, what am I calling them in the book? I think pumpkin balls. At one point we were calling them Foxy Cleopatras after the performer, because we wanted a sexy name for it. But I think they're in there as Foxy Pumpkins, maybe. I don't know. Mm-hmm. One of those things.
Yeah.
But it's basically a pumpkin. It's like pumpkin meatballs, which to me are just delicious. Like, I love pumpkin anyway, maybe because I'm a daughter of Oshun, but like, I just love pumpkin. So instead of using meat, it uses mashed pumpkin, and you put all the spices, and, you know, it's got this really amazing creme fraiche made with balsamic vinegar. So that's delightful. And that's sort of like a dipping sauce for it. It's so good. Oh my gosh. I could eat that all the time.
Yeah. I have to say, that was the one I was like, okay, that is definitely a try soon. Cause I too love anything with pumpkin. I'm not a big like pumpkin spice person, but actual pumpkin. Yes. Bring it.
Yeah. I like the savory pumpkin too. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, my daughter and I went to Germany, say maybe 3 years ago, like, and everything we were served in Germany had pumpkin in it. We had no idea. We were like, look, some more pumpkin ravioli, pumpkin meatballs. It was wild, but it's delightful. I love it.
Yeah. The, when I lived in Slovenia for a while in college and have gone back to visit several times, and they do like this roasted pumpkin seed oil,
ooh, nice.
Like as a finishing oil on so much stuff. And it is the most unique flavor. Like it is, I had just never experienced it before, but it is delicious. And they grow pumpkins more for seed than for eating, which I thought was really interesting.
That sounds great. Oh my gosh, I want to try that now.
Yeah, I know you can order it online. I have yet to find it in a store locally, but you can order online. It's like toasted pumpkin seed oil, and it has that kind of like toasted sesame. Like it has that kind of flavor that just permeates everything, but it makes the best salad dressing I've ever had in my life. So,
all right, I'm going to try
Totally recommend if you're into pumpkin. Another layer of pumpkin. It's also good on pumpkin, of course.
I'm definitely trying this.
Oh, it's nice to talk cooking and writing.
I know.
So for the book, like one of the things you touched on this about the layers of research to do that. So did you unearth something that surprised you in all of that and kind of that while you were delving into all these different views on tarot?
Well, one of the things that I really like about the book is that it incorporates a lot of interviews I've done over the years with famous readers and authors and things like that. And that's what really surprised me, because I think I thought that there was going to be more commonality in what we said. You know, I just mentioned, you know, Dorothy Morrison, Deb Lipp, Matt Oren, like they're all in the book, you know, and their advice was all really good. But a lot of times it's sort of opened my eyes to either something I had done that I didn't even realize I knew that I was doing, which was fascinating, you know, or a different way of looking at things that was how they had sort of gleaned knowledge from this technique or this, you know, interaction with the cards. And that's what was really fascinating to me, that there was such difference in what they were saying, you know, and because, you know, some people are sit there with the book, like, you know, memorize the book, whatever, you know, some people are like throw away the book, you know. There are so many different techniques about those traditional meanings, you know, and everybody seemed to have their own unique opinion on it, which was surprising to me, but it works for them. So it might work for the readers going through this. Oh, okay. Maybe I feel better if I memorize it and then throw it away. Or maybe I feel better if I use the Toth deck and then I just go with the word that's printed on the card as the meaning and then take that as a springboard to more information from the thing. Maybe it's, you know, Morrison said to me, do you have meditations? And I do. There's sort of like guided meditations where you're walking through each of the cards. And that was something that was really important to me because maybe because it's I'm a filmmaker, but I sort of having yourself mentally go through visualizing yourself walking through these cards, walking up to the Empress or the Emperor or walking, you know, spinning around with the Wheel of Fortune, all of those things are going to make you understand it in a deeper way. And I think that's really valuable.
Yeah. The meditations reminded me of kind of like Mind Palace work. Like I was like, oh, this totally makes sense to me to, especially like I was thinking how valuable that would be to people who are especially have no preconceptions at all to have that experience would be really interesting. I was like, wouldn't it be great sometimes now that you've learned things to go back and incorporate that before you made mistakes. Unfortunately, we can't do that. So we just layer it on top of what we already know. But I so appreciated that part of the book. That's really interesting.
No, because for me, ultimately, it's about your own interaction with it. You know what I mean? So when you're walking into your Mind Palace of Tarot, what do you see there? Yes, you're going to see certain things, but that could be a wide variety in the reality of what you're really looking at. Right. You know what I mean? Like the child could be any race, any ethnicity, any gender, you know, the chariot could be any shape, any form, any, you know, any animals pulling it, all these things, you know? So what you see there is going to be unique to you. And that's going to help you most with when you're reading for yourself or others. And you're going to remember that too. You're going to remember that moment when you saw those things, when you were doing that meditation, that visualization, when you go back and you get the card, even if you're not taking the time to do that every time.
So you've been reading for a long time. Do you find that your, I guess, understanding of the cards, is it for you now more about your intuition or about what actually shows up on the table when you're reading for other people?
I think it depends, you know, most of the time it's more about what I'm seeing with the cards, but intuition also plays a really big part. especially if there's some sort of trauma or something unusual going on with somebody. You know, I don't think I wrote about it in the book, but I did do a reading for somebody once that was in a unique situation where their partner was going through the sort of a lot of abuse and trauma and stuff from the past, which normally I wouldn't say that to somebody, but there was that intuition, spidey sense in my head where I need to say that this person is going through this. And they were like, oh my gosh, how did you know? And I was like, there was just something that, like, you know, and I apologized ahead of time. I'm like, if this person is not dealing with this kind of thing, I apologize for mentioning it, but is this what they're dealing with? And it was, you know, so those moments are always really strong for me when something comes in and is just like, whatever. Although most of the time it's like, this person shouldn't worry at all. And people have, I would be happy about that if I got it in a reading, but usually people are like, what? But it seems like a really difficult problem and I want to worry and, you know.
You're like, no, this says you're going to be okay.
Yeah, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. Yeah.
I always think of those memes of like, you've asked your tarot cards like 3-4 times. Does he love me? And then they just, the tarot cards spell it, dump him on the floor. I'm like, sometimes it's really obvious, you know, like, yeah.
Well, I mean, that could be the best thing. You know, I do talk about in the book how I had a friend that was obsessed with having this relationship and they got the relationship. And then it turned out the person, it was during the AIDS huge outbreak. And then they ended up both dying, you know? So it was like, just because this is the person that you think you want doesn't mean it's the best situation for either of you, you know? Why don't you just work on concentrating on having the best situation for you come to you, you know? And that might not be the partner you're with, or it might not be the partner that you're obsessing about, or anything really, the job, the house, the whatever, the car. You know, there could be, maybe you could get a free car the next day. So you don't want to buy that car. Maybe there's something wrong with that car. Maybe there's something wrong with that house. So it's more about aligning yourself with the universe and trusting the process and receiving and making actionable steps where you can to make it happen.
Yeah. I know. I think so much about like public or professional readers, just because I think, you know, like actual mental health help is so expensive and difficult to access. Like a lot of that probably walks through your door in a way that really you're like, yes, I can do this for you, but you know, this may be beyond what I can tell you in this setting. Is that, how do you cope with that or work with that?
Some people just have to learn, you know? I mean, I had a client a few years ago that really, I think his girlfriend had called his mother a dirty word. So he was trying to figure out how to heal that situation and get the everybody happy again. And I was like, I can do it, but it's not the right relationship for you. And he wanted to do it anyway. And he said, what happens when you do this kind of thing? And I said, well, most of the time people aren't happy anyway. And you know, just because you get what it is you think you want doesn't mean you're going to be happy. It doesn't mean it's going to be the best thing, you know? So I try and tell them how they can hear it. If they can't hear it, I do send them to go get some kind of psychiatric help or something like that. You know, there's some problems the cards or spirituality can't fix.
I think that to me seems like the challenge of being, like I said, a public or professional reader is sometimes you're just going to have people come in and you're like, you're at the wrong table. Let's talk about somewhere else you can go and get some help.
Yeah. I mean, I think that comes with it being any kind of spiritual person. You know, it doesn't even matter what denomination. I belong to the Voodoo Spiritual Temple here in New Orleans. And as we were talking before, there's a lot of disparity of wealth here. There's a lot of homeless people. And, you know, they had discovered somebody in a garbage can. They were alive, but they were just, they decided to take up residence in the garbage can. So it's just, it's sad. And they got them some help and they got them to a shelter and things like that. But it happens sometimes.
So we try to keep it to an hour. Like, I'm not great about that. I think you and I probably are going to go over.
It's fine.
It's all good. but before we get to our game of chance question at the end, I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of plug whatever you would like or where people can learn more about your work or find you for readings or whatever you want to share. And like I said, this will come out on October. So think about that time frame.
Okay, great. Well, people can always find me on my website, lilithdorsey.com. There's a list of my upcoming events that's there. We're doing a huge New Orleans National Voodoo Day celebration in, I want to say, March of next year. So hopefully that'll give people still time to plan. I'm also in charge of a symposium attached to that, so you can find out more information about that on my website. You can find me on all social media channels, YouTube channel, blog, Voodoo Universe. I'm all over the place. It's tiring, but
but you can find Lilith in many locations. Great.
Yes.
Good. All right. So our last question is a little bit of a game of chance. And I always joke that my Scorpio nature is to want to talk about, like, you know, meet a new person, ask them what they think happens after we die. I don't know how to do small talk.
So, that's fine.
So I'm going to roll a die, and depending on what number I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money.
Oh,
and if
okay.
I roll a six, you'll get to pick which one you want, and you can pass.
Oh, so, all right.
So let's see what we get. Three. Religion.
Okay.
So I was thinking about this partly because of your YouTube channel, and I wanted to ask you, of the mainstream media depictions of New Orleans voodoo, which one is the most faithful and really gets it right and isn't just scaremongering and being racist about it, I guess?
I think my favorite one would be Yves Bayou. I already mentioned it, but it's not really New Orleans, but it's Louisiana Bayou country. Mm-hmm. I think Kazi Lemons, Black director, first major Black female director for a Hollywood film. So she gets a lot of it right. She also directed the film about Harriet Tubman a couple of years ago. So she's got a treatment of the material that's experimental that I think is necessary when you're really dealing with some of these spiritual things. The cast is amazing. You know, Diane Carroll is El Zora, the swamp witch. You know, I think we all know somebody like that. I'm well on my way to El Zora, the swamp witch.
Goals.
Yeah. So that's my favorite. That's definitely my favorite. So
is there one Samuel that you Jackson. Just like to flog on for just being horrific?
Oh, there's
probably
so many.
what
is it? The three more days till Halloween, Silver Shamrock. That's the one. Samhain, you know?
Yeah.
That particular... what is it? Halloween 2, Halloween 3? It's one of those.
Yeah.
Season of the Witch. I think it's Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, but it's so bad. They don't say Samhain in the whole thing. They call it Samhain. And it's, you know, murderous leprechauns. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So, yeah. But there's so many that are bad. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many that are really bad. And I hope we're really at the point now where we're demanding, you know, better depictions. I mean, I know more consultants are being hired. I don't know if it's translating into better films in the end result, but at least we're getting there, hopefully.
Yeah.
And it'll be more and more. And I think as audience members too, we have to know that this is not factual. And if all the information I have about witchcraft or voodoo or something like that is coming from bad movies, then it's my duty to go and find out the real truth about that. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like so much of the mainstream media, at least in the past, and I think you're right, I think things are getting a little better, but it's so much scaremongering, like from this kind of overculture Christian viewpoint of just, you know, if you touch this Ouija board or this tarot deck or stand in the circle, you have condemned yourself to, you know, hellfire and whatever. And it's kind of old at this point.
It is. It's so old and so tiresome at this point. And I just can't, you know, tired of all of it.
Yeah. I mean, I've always been interested in like films like The Wicker Man and Midsommar and kind of these folk horror approaches and kind of show one of the things I appreciate about them is they're using European folklore in this scary thing instead of demonizing other cultures for the mass media enjoyment, which I've always found kind of an interesting dichotomy from some other things. Cause I think so many times in movies, like especially voodoo and other ATRs show up as the scary, as the bad, you know, and I'm like, you know, European folklore is pretty got its got some weirdness there too.
Yeah. I mean, it's all about othering, right? Like, yeah. So in that we've got the other as somebody who's in the community, mm-hmm. but is a little bit weird, you know, and gets labeled as the witch. The same thing happens with vampires, you mm-hmm. know, like, yeah. Oh, here's this. I wrote a piece about beware the ginger vampire, you know, like, were they people that had some sort of genetic predisposition to like redheads, light skin, they can't go out in the sun, that kind of thing that turned into this, you know, anti-ginger hatred. Mm-hmm. You know, and in the same way as witches, oh, here's somebody who's a little strange out in the swamp, knows something about herb medicines or whatever. Mm-hmm. And now they're being demonized as, oh, she eats babies, right? Like,
yeah.
And as an anthropologist, I know that's the first thing they always say when they're, you know, trying to colonize and invade and conquer mm-hmm. a country. These people eat babies because that's like the worst thing
yeah.
people can think of. So it doesn't surprise me that it's been attached to the mythology about witches or even about the goddess Lilith for, mm-hmm. you know, thousands of years, because they're just trying to paint this picture of us as evil and weird and dangerous to small children.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, just the shorthand for like darkness and evil. And mm-hmm. it's just, yeah, there's a lot of like, yeah, I hope it's changing. I mean, sometimes stuff will come out and I'll just kind of roll my eyes, but you know. That's pop culture.
So, yeah, that's where we're at.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, Lilith, thank you so much for coming on and talking about your book and all that you do. And I'm excited for all the things that come next and hope you get to rest in there too.
Oh, thank you. I had a wonderful time and thank you so much for having me on. It was a delight.
Oh, lovely. Witch Lit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.